Game of Thrones 2, Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, Steve and I cover The Queen's Justice. This is the third episode of the seventh season. We see the long-awaited meeting between Dany and Jon. The Unsullied take Casterly Rock, and we say farewell to Lady Olenna. Also, Bran returns to Winterfell, and then the question is this an emotional reunion, or is this completely devoid of emotion? Because Bran now has the personality of a tree. All right, after that discussion, I invited my friend Stephanie Barbe Hammer back to talk about her new book that's just been published. As you might imagine, podcasts run on favors among colleagues, and Stephanie is more than just a colleague to me. She's an old friend, so I wanted to promote her book. It's called Pretend Plumber. If you have enjoyed Stephanie on this podcast, and if you enjoyed funny books, this is a great book. I had not read it when I interviewed her, but I have since read it, and it's probably my favorite of all of her books. So we talk a little bit about that. It's just about 5 minutes at the end. Summer reading, Pretend Plumber. Okay, without further ado, here is comic Steve Osborne. Steve, we're going to play underrated, overrated, or properly rated again. And we will begin with sliced bread.
I mean, it's elevated to the point where it is... It's the benchmark, right, of all inventions?
It really has become the benchmark, right?
Of all inventions. I mean, we have spacecraft traveling to Mars, collecting data and minerals.
Yeah, but it can only be the best thing since sliced bread.
Nothing has, to this day, I mean, that, when you talk about radium, nothing has eclipsed, according to modern vernacular, nothing has eclipsed sliced bread. Now, that's going to be a big moment. The day that we say that's the greatest invention since something other than sliced bread is going to be like the day that November Rain took over Thriller as the top video of all time.
So we're going to need an answer from you, Steve. Sliced bread.
I'm going to go ahead and say properly rated.
Really? Because I like to tear my bread apart. I mean... But I haven't been making a whole lot of sandwiches lately.
So. Yeah. Well, so here's the thing about tearing your bread apart. Usually, like, you're on your way to the beach and go, oh, crap, I didn't bring any thing to cut this bread with. And so there's, like, a certain romance of taking and dipping it right into the Safeway brand spinach dip. And then and then you don't do it again for, like, another year. So but sliced bread, for some people, it can be a daily occurrence. That they engage with sliced bread. So there's not that many inventions. I mean, like, I would say that, to me, I would probably feel comfortable with changing the way we think a little bit and say, like, the greatest invention since squared toilet paper. Mm-hmm. But even then, I would make the argument that, like, do we really need squares? I mean, who's going one square at a time? Like, what if, like, we need to do sheets?
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that.
If toilet paper came pre-clumped.
The fact that toilet paper is in squares is both aesthetically pleasing because it looks like a nice even square, but also the more incremental you make it, the more you can choose the size you want.
Sure. I would say that if toilet paper weren't in the slices like bread is,
sure.
That would actually be okay because you talked about pulling out, just ripping apart bread. We could easily just rip apart toilet paper to our liking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Doesn't look as nice.
No.
My bread to look nice. Because like I said, the sliced bread presumes that I'm eating sandwiches.
You could eat toast.
Again, you could toast a clump of bread.
No, you can't. You don't make a toaster where you just shove shove.
I have one. It's called a toaster oven.
Yeah, that seems handy.
And I can just...
And you just throw a wad of bread in there.
No, just but me. I could.
I want to toast the outer edges of this ball of bread.
I might do it just to prove you wrong.
This fist of bread needs to be toasted on the outside, and it needs to be soft on the inside. Nice. No, and here's the thing. I don't need my toilet paper to look nice either because I know the end game.
It presumes you're going to have guests and, you know.
Oh, and I'm going to present my poop on top of it for them in a nice little square.
You're going to present your bathroom or loo in a manner that suggests that you're not a savage.
It's a ruse. The whole thing is a ruse.
Yeah, I know. That's exactly. Exactly. Sometimes the ruses we choose say a lot about us.
If you're going into my bathroom to poop and you're mm-hmm. a guest, mm-hmm. One of us has done something wrong.
I disagree, man. I feel like
that's the height of intimacy.
Honestly, you could come in with me. You could sit on the tub. We could just present you the conversation. Right.
We'll deposit one square at a time because I want to keep this ruse going. Oh, how do you do it?
All right, final category: civility.
Overrated.
Is it overrated? Because I think...
I'm not saying that it's used a lot, but I'm just saying that people hearken to it. Like, oh, why can't we be more civil? Well, the fact that we can't shows that we need to stop talking about it.
I think, okay, sure. I mean, I think you're right. I think that for whatever reason, civility was overrated.
Civility is a ruse. That's your ruse.
And I think now it's a little underrated.
Civility is squared toilet paper.
Yeah, well, you know how I feel about square toilet paper.
Right, but you agree it's a ruse.
It's the ruse I choose. All right, now let me ask you a different kind of question. Is Lady Elena, is she civil? Because I think that many would say that she's uncouth.
Sure.
You know, she's direct. I think that in comparison to maybe a few other characters, maybe not... in comparison to, like, the mountain. But I'm curious what you think. Is Lady Elena civil?
I think, well, if we're going to keep with this theme, I think that it is the ruse of civility.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I think that that's a lot of what's going on in the Game of Thrones world, right? I mean, I think the Varys Littlefinger back and forth, before they split their ways, I think was mm-hmm. was a really good way to sum up the culture, right?
Right. Yeah.
And even when you don't, you know, you want to agree with Varys, but it was hard to disagree with Littlefinger's assessment.
Well, no one's more civil than those two, right? And yet,
right. I mean,
and yet their power sort of undermines their, you know, the fact that they have power proves that the civility is a ruse.
Right. And the method in which they get it. Right. So Varys is a very interesting comparison to Littlefinger because he plays the, I'm here to serve. I'm here to serve. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, no, you're here to survive for one thing. And the ability to survive suggests some level of power. Cause you're not scraping by on the skin of your teeth here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You're usually surrounded by people with power who you serve that puts you in a position of, you know, a favorable position compared to most, right? So he's like, even when he says everything he's trying to do is for the people because that's where he's from, it suggests a past tense, right? He is offering that which he is no, you know, to those who he is no longer really a part of. But he empathizes. So there is a sense of, you can only be compassionate for something that you're above.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. There's a certain power dynamic at work there, and I think he knows that the common people don't have the kind of power he has. And I think he's aware. I think he's aware that he's also a survivor.
But I think but it's an interesting, you know, juxtaposition is a big factor, I think, when it comes to how we rate anything. And I think we've already through that, right? I mean, the very fact that we talked about sliced bread, we talked about how it compares to everything else going forward.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing with the civility, right? It's like, okay, well, compared to the mountain or compared to this person or compared to that, it's like, exactly. So that's, you know, that's how we define things is compared to whatever. And then in this particular case, when you ask about Lady Olenna, is she civil? It's like, well, she appears to be. And that appearance is important. And compared to, you know, you start looking around and go, well, I guess she's the most civil that we've seen in some ways. But But that doesn't necessarily make civility. It just means less of the other, right? And so that's the same kind of thing with Varys. I mean, Varys compared to Littlefinger seems much more altruistic. You strip all that down and you're like, well, here's a guy looking to survive, and not just survive, but looking to thrive, right? I mean, you could have made the argument at one point that the High Sparrow was like, well, here's a guy who's just trying. He's not interested in thriving, but he's interested in serving. And then we find out, of course, that's not the case. But
so the way that Olenna dies at the end of this episode, you know, this exchange between her and Jaime, aside from the odd curse word, it's very polite. The whole thing is very sort of high society. And even the way she dies, she's going to die painlessly. You know, she takes her medicine, you know, like a big girl. Mm. And, you know,
well, she does, but she also does it. She takes her medicine because she knows she wants to get the last word and she doesn't want to get flayed or do
exactly.
As soon as she drank it, I'm like, oh, she's about to drop some nuggets of truth.
See, on the surface of it, both Jaime and Olenna are wearing their masks through this entire exchange. I mean, everything about the whole thing, like, he's there to kill her, right?
Right.
You know, she's there to reveal that she murdered Joffrey.
Right.
And so the whole thing, you know, the masks are important. The masks are kind of pristine. It's what keeps the whole system moving, right? Keeps the wheels greased. And yet these are two, like, murdering sons of bitches talking to each other. Like, every bit as murdering and sons of bitchy as, you know, the Hound or Bronn. And I think that maybe that's why those two are a little bit... are interesting, because they refuse to wear the high society mask.
Right. And then it shows, like, you know, and that's sort of stripping down the idea that that the higher up you are, the more civil or more, you know, proper. It's just, you've decided that you're going to have to put these airs on if that's what you're going to try to... If you're going to navigate this culture, right? But which is interesting, because she still does it up to the bitter end, right? I mean, she lays out the truth about how she had, because she's, you know, this is her last word, and she's like, look, I'm going to die, but I want to stick it, right? And so there's a fun, I don't know if it's fun is the right word, but in terms of parallels, right? You have, you know, what Cersei does to Dorne lady, I forget her name.
Ellaria.
Ellaria, yeah. And so that's very drawn out, right? And it's very, this is my revenge. You took my daughter.
And she kind of loses the mask just a little bit, like when she says, why did you do that? And then she kind of, like, collects herself and says, actually, it doesn't matter. Now, and, you know, in my very staid tone of voice, I'm going to describe to you this horrible... torturous scenario I'm going to put you through.
Right.
Right. Okay. So,
and then by contrast, you have Lady Olenna, who's very, you know, also proper, but at the same time, she's like, I already did this to you. I need you to know. So, like, there is this little sense of kind of circular comeuppance.
Now, contrast with that, my impression of the exchange between John and Danny, who finally meet, right?
Mm hmm.
My impression of John is, like, he doesn't have a mask. Like, he either never learned to wear a mask, or he just hates masks, or whatever it is. But he's, everywhere he goes, he's Jon Snow, and he's going to say exactly what's on his mind. And he's quite vulnerable in this world that sort of runs with masks, right? The masks keep everything, it's the ruse everyone's chosen, so... But he's got none. He's just Jon Snow.
Right. There was no moment either where, like, I mean, you would think that there'd have been a moment like, if I'm going to be the king of the North, I can't do it as Jon Snow. And somebody somewhere would have to bless him as Jon Stark, right?
Or something, like give him a new name or, you
yeah,
know.
Yeah, and they didn't, and there's none of that. In fact, I believe that even comes up, right? Like,
oh, yeah, because Danny's got, like, titles upon titles.
Yeah, that was great when Davos, for the first time in the history of Davos,
is pithy.
Didn't have much to say.
You stand in the presence of Daenerys Stormborn of House Targaryen, rightful heir to the Iron Throne, rightful queen of the Andals and the First Men, protector of the Seven Kingdoms, the mother of dragons, the Khaleesi of the Great Grass Sea, the Unburnt, the Breaker of Chains.
This is Jon Snow. He's king in the north.
Look, I'm not a I'm not a highborn man. I'm a common folk. I don't understand all the different titles and get on with it.
Like before I introduce Jon Snow, let me tell you the story about my fingers.
I can count on that one hand how many titles Jon has. This hand specifically.
Yeah, that was a great scene. And then, of course, Davos does get a little carried away with the monologue later.
Right, yeah, he has his moment.
I mean, he couldn't keep it in for long.
Yeah, and then John's like, hey, could you not talk about me being undead for a little bit?
I just met her. There may be something here. I don't want her to know that I'm a zombie.
Look, she's kind of hot. I'm not saying I'm interested, but also, like, maybe, like ease into the zombie thing.
So those two, I think both of those two, like, they don't have much of a mask. Like, even Dany, when Dany's putting on airs, I think that's who she really thinks she is, right?
Mm-hmm.
She really thinks she is all of those titles. And she really does think that a proper acknowledgement of who she really is means that he's got to bend the knee.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big, big deal. I mean, she's, and it is, yeah, you're right. I think she's being true. Now, whether or not she's being right or civil, that's another conversation. Mm-hmm. But she definitely, like, we talked about this sort of building up of, like, her own press kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And she makes some compelling points, right? When she talks about everything that she's had to go through to get to where she is. It definitely, you know, you're like, yeah, I mean, if you wear it, you know, you've been through it. But, you know, and John's kind of like, I died, okay? Like, that's kind of a big deal. but John doesn't, but that's the weird part. And that's where I think John is, like, he's just like, I'm not into that, right? And that's where it makes him kind of an odd king of the North, right? Is that you get the sense that Rob would have been a lot more stomp his foot type of thing, right?
Maybe so. And I think that there's something important about the way that those two have interacted with Melisandre, right? Because Melisandre is pretty certain that Jon is special.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes maybe Jon a little bit more suspicious of her. Like, you're a bit too religious for me, because I don't think I'm that special.
Right.
Whereas Dany accepts Mel in, and Mel says, actually, you're pretty special, and there's a prophecy that might include you. And Dany wants to read that like, well, I know that I am special. And tell me more about this prophecy, and, you know, give me more of the religious stuff. Because, and I think that it kind of gets revealed in this episode when she says, you know, she goes through this litany of all of the suffering that she's undergone, which is not insignificant, right?
Right.
And she says, what's kept me through is my faith, not in any God, not in politics or whatever, but in myself. To modern Western ears, that sounds a little bit like, you know, believe in yourself, be true to yourself, that sort of thing. But I don't think that that's what she means. I think she really is reading her own press.
Yeah. No, I think you're right.
I think she's like, I'm the religion here. I'm the only religion that matters.
When she stepped out of the fire, I think that's when she became a believer, right? Sure. Like, I am this. And
that's right. That's
and right. you can believe it or you can get burnt, because this is the way it is. Like, that's where I see the faith.
Yeah.
And that's what's kind of fascinating about this, the two of them coming together, right? I mean, this is a, even though it feels understated in many ways, because they're just sort of looking at each other and just sort of chatting, you know, like, mm-hmm. And, you know, it's, there's a little bit of puffing up or whatever, but Jon is so Jon is, to some degree, what Dany claims to be. Like, Dany claims
she's like a woman of the people or whatever, but
woman
Jon
of the
really
people.
Is.
She has one goal, and that is their best interest. Uh-huh. And Jon is like, look, I'm only here. I'm here against my council. I'm here against every recommendation. I'm here against even, you know, my father's made some of these mistakes. I'm here because you have something that I believe will save my people. Mm-hmm. And really not just my people, but maybe all the people. And I care about that more than anything. And even the not bending the knee moment doesn't feel so much prideful as it is, if I bend the knee, like I can't, and then my people aren't gonna buy what I'm trying. And like the whole thing is, I didn't ask to be reborn. Mm-hmm. I didn't ask to be the king, but I'm here I am, and I got to do this. And Dany claims to be that, right? And I think even Tyrion is like, well, that's why we're all following her. But like we talked a little bit in the past about how, you know, yeah, that, and I think he's got some dragon worship going on, right? Whereas Jon is just,
I think so. Yeah.
Jon is the real deal. And Ned was in many ways the real deal. And, but he didn't seem as reluctant. I mean, reluctance, I think, is a thing that Ned and Jon probably maybe have the most in common.
I think he's a lot like Ned in a lot of ways, and I think it may end up getting him killed. I think it's like, I mean, in other words, the circumstance, I think if he was in Ned's position, I don't know if he would do anything differently than Ned did.
Right. Yeah. If you look at what Ned went through, I would agree with that. It's hard to imagine. But does he have even more compassion than Ned?
I don't know. It's a good question. He has a different role than Ned. I mean, they both have sort of taken off people's heads because they thought it was their duty to do it.
Right.
You know, he's been in different contexts. Like, for instance, there's something about Ned, I think, that would have really thrived as a ranger up north of the Wall. He's a direct guy. He's pretty good with a sword.
Is Jon better at the bigger picture to some degree? Like maybe, I think Ned is better at the political bigger picture. Whereas I think Jon might be just like, at least right now in this situation, it's all White Walkers. Like he doesn't care about, and he even said it, right? He says so much. It's like, well, we're out here fumbling around or stumbling over each other. There's a real threat coming on.
Yeah, that's not insignificant, right?
And that is because that's a huge moment, right? That runs contrary to everything, and that has to rub somebody like Dany like the wrong way, or at least chafe a little bit, where it's like, look, I'm all in on the game, and Tyrion's all in on the game, and then in comes this guy speaking some language that nobody has spoken that we've run into at this point. I mean, the closest thing would be the High Sparrow, but the High Sparrow also was very agenda driven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had a mask for sure.
Yeah, so Jon is like, look, there is a threat coming to us all. Like, we can hit pause on this little game, because I don't think he cares enough about it anyway. So it's easier for Jon to look at this kind of threat because, as far as he's concerned, he's like, look, remember when Rob was questioned, I think by Talisa, was like, hey, what are you going to do?
Yeah, sure.
If you take him off the throne, then what is? Well, I'm going to come back home. It's like, well, then what? Then somebody else can just fill in. So if you either do this all the way, or why do it at all? And for Jon, he's like, look, he was going to leave the Wall. He didn't want anything to do with anything. And then, well, Rickon is there, and it's like, oh, okay, great.
So a little meta commentary here. I really love this exchange between Tyrion and Jon, where Jon is like, look, I'm telling you that there's an actual undead army coming for you. How are you not taking this seriously? Tyrion replies with, it's just kind of unreasonable. What you're asking Daenerys to do is just kind of unreasonable. Then he says, people's minds aren't made for problems that big. Right? And I think that, and he says, it's almost a comfort to confront a monster like Cersei because, you know, she's, you know, Cersei just looks the part of, you know, like the evil queen or whatever.
Right.
And in, you know, sort of post-show, George Martin said in so many words that the White Walkers are something of a metaphor for climate change.
Mm.
And, he's talking about, hey, look, we're all squabbling over politics and there's this real threat on the horizon. And here we are. So it's almost like I really like this exchange between the two, because you're right that John does see this big picture. Like, you know, this is all, we're all children playing at, you know, the Game of Thrones, when in reality there's this, you know, the end of the human race as we know it is sort of
right
beyond the horizon.
Well, and it's a good moment too, I think, because it's easy to be, and I think, and that's what I've been saying kind of throughout the podcast, is that like that's what the show really feels like, right? Is that while there's this major threat, and they've done a really good job as showrunners and as an author, I assume too, in showing you just enough of that danger, and then you forget about it.
You totally forget about it, because a threat like Cersei is more comforting because you can get your brain around it, right?
Yeah, and so as an audience member, you're like, oh, that's right, and I think that has been such an effective use of this threat, right? Because you get caught up in it. You get caught up in all the intrigue, and then it's like, yeah, and all that means nothing if they just come through with zombie giants and wipe everybody out. And that's a real thing right now. And that that part is pretty great. It's one of my favorite elements of the show, and I really like too that, you know, you're kind of, for the most part, I think people are rooting for Dany for all the right reasons, right? Mm. You know, because, hey, she may be the one to stop Cersei from all of her nonsense.
Well, she has the tools to combat the White Walkers.
Right, so there's all these things about it. And then when Jon comes in and says, we're all children, that's where Tyrion, even though the some of the battle hasn't gone his way, Tyrion's value so far has really been shown in the Jon Dany interaction, because she could have easily just thrown him out, done whatever, but he's like, no, he's the Jiminy Cricket that's like, he didn't say you were a child. He said, we were all like children. Mm-hmm. He basically he's like, he's not denying your status, but he's saying by comparison, you know, that's, so I think that there's something really valuable there, because she is, if she's a true believer in herself, it's hard to hear anything from another angle. And Tyrion, this, you know, it almost doesn't matter what happens in the other battles, even though that's sort of her goal. Like, if he moves her towards this White Walker, then so that's where it's like, it's an interesting play too, a very subtle way to show that Tyrion's value here is still valuable, even if tactically he may not be, you know, Euron may have, you know, poisoned the well there or whatever.
Boy, Euron, man, he makes an entrance.
Euron comes in there like he's Tywin on a horse.
He comes in. I was actually thinking all of that bad boy energy that Jaime used to have.
Mm-hmm.
Euron's got that and then some.
Oh, yeah, and he's made it very clear that he doesn't think Jaime's got even an ounce.
Oh, yeah, and he comes in, and Jaime's looking at him like, this guy, he's a legitimate badass, and he's probably better than me at this point, and he'll probably take my sister away, and there's really nothing I can do about it. I mean, by comparison, Euron is just making Jaime look impotent.
Oh, yeah.
And I think Cersei knows exactly what's happening. I think she knows exactly what's happening. I think Cersei is doing a really great job at using the resources that she has. She tells Euron, you can have what your heart desires. In other words, you can have me when the war's won. And she can still keep Jaime on the hook. She's got, she's got Euron on the hook. She's got the Iron Bank on the hook. And
she can get, here's the thing, she's like, look, if this war gets won, and then Jaime, you know, if Jaime wants to off Euron, or Euron gets killed in battle, she's like, all the better, all this goes in there. And, you know, it's like, she's never She's all about just get this done. Everybody, she's using all these men as pawns at this point.
Yeah, and that's right.
Jamie, Heather's whole take is like, is Jamie going to die this episode? He's got to die soon. He's getting pretty boring.
All right. Well, we did have, Lady Elena, she dies. And in addition to that, she tells Jamie that Cersei's going to be the death of him.
Yeah.
Which almost seems a little bit like a portent, right?
Yeah.
And then we have Mel tell Varys. She says, I've got to die in this strange land, as do you.
Do you, yeah.
So, or just like you or whatever. And so it's almost like the writing's on the wall for a lot of these characters. And so probably, Heather's probably really right. Like, you're just kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop for a number of characters here. I mean, quite literally, if anyone knows that Varys is going to die, you think that Mel would have some, you almost believe Mel when she says that kind of stuff. I don't know. I mean, she's been wrong before, but.
Which is, yeah, I mean, that is a fun little version of Mel, where it's like, and I kind of made the comment, I'm like, man, she's been around for a long time. She's got to have a pretty good batting average if right now she seems to be befuddled. She was always burning the right people.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead, unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
There was an interesting theme of sort of the father's sins. Should the children be held accountable for their father's sins in this episode? So, like... Danny, you know, Danny's acknowledging that her father was evil, and you know, she ends up asking John for forgiveness. That is a little olive branch that she's offering. And John turns it around and says, yeah, no, you're not responsible for your father's sins. And at the same time, I'm not beholden to my ancestors' vows.
Yeah, it was kind of a fun little complicated back and forth, because one hand she'd be like, oh, I'm not responsible for this, but then she would still hold him accountable for that, you know. So it was
It was great. Now, okay, I want to talk about what wasn't great. All right, so that scene went on forever, and it really deserved all the space it took up, I thought.
Yeah, I agree.
And because it just felt like there was so much time spent on Dragonstone in that throne room and with the back and forth and the different, you know, Davos has to talk with John, and then John has to talk with Dany, and then John has to talk with Tyrion, and then Tyrion has to talk with... I mean, all of that is worthwhile. And I felt like that was almost an entire episode in and of itself. And then the second half of this episode had some really odd pacing issues. It's like Jaime's at King's Landing, and now he's in the, you know, he's back in the middle of, you know, Highgarden. And, you know, that you have this whole siege of Casterly Rock, and then you have right after that a siege of Highgarden, and it's almost like they were pushing like four episodes into like a half of an episode.
Which, so this goes back to like we talked about how this is a truncated, we have two seasons.
That's right.
And you know, and I'm like, okay, well, it, and you know, you need that space in between, and there's this sense of like, oh, well, I read one thing said, oh, well, it was supposed to be 10 episodes, this was supposed to be the final season, and then they end up giving you some extra episodes because they make a season 8 out of it. But then even that feels like, well, I read something else that said, oh, there's supposed to be 10 seasons total, so this is still condensed. So it's almost as if they see the end, and I don't know when they make these decisions, right? I mean, they've already filmed a lot of this, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I think that this is an editing choice, right? Because you've got all the footage, and then you have to decide how to cut it, and somewhere along the way, they decide to just press fast forward.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like, and I get it, you know, you've got this massive ensemble cast, and how are you going to tie everything up? Well, you're going to have to fast forward a few of these plot lines. These are some pretty major plot lines to fast forward.
Right, yeah, especially when you're like, oh, here's the Unsullied getting ready to take it, you know, and they're like, oh, yeah, and they take it.
Well, I think that's part of, I mean, so that... The pacing of this episode felt different than any other episode.
Mm-hmm.
It felt like both the fast forward, and they were doing a Tyrion's sort of heist type voiceover of a siege. We have not seen that before. And I'm not saying that it wasn't necessarily effective, but it certainly didn't feel like Game of Thrones.
So far, I mean, season 7 doesn't feel like it's a drag.
Well, I think that I don't think it's a drag. I do feel like it's a little bit, so far it's like, am I watching Game of, like, people have fallen in love with Game of Thrones and now they're tinkering with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like all these new baseball rules. It's like, okay, people have loved this game for 150 years. Let's add 14 new rules and see how people like it then, you know?
Right, right.
And it's like, yeah, but you had a method and it was working pretty well. Like, did you need Ed Sheeran? Probably not.
Right.
Did you need to push four episodes into one episode? Probably not. So I don't know. I mean, I think people are starting to get a little suspicious at this point. Like, are they fast tracking this thing? Are they really giving? Because I think what would normally happen with all of these plot lines is that you do an episode like this in three episodes, and then you'd give me a little bit of the Hound mixed in, and you'd give me a little bit of, you know, some of these B type characters stories just to kind of hook me along, and you'd stretch it out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like, nope, let's kill the B-type characters and let's push the A characters together because we gotta get where we need to go.
Yeah, no, and that, but it seems like there's an inevitability of that's gonna, like, as you start moving towards resolve, even if it ends well, there's like, well, there's a reluctance to go there, I think, mm-hmm. as an audience member, right? Because like, okay, here's the big Dany and Jon Snow moment, right? But let's be real. A season ago, that wasn't even an option. Yeah. No one gave a shit. No one gave a shit that those two may meet because it's not even on the radar. And then once it starts to be on the radar, within a few episodes, they meet, right? Like, and I guess the old Game of Thrones might be two seasons before we finally get to it. But you don't have two seasons, right? So that's the other part of it, is at some point it's going to come to an end, and you have to move these pieces together, and you're going to do it in a way that no matter what, you're going to have to start moving these pieces.
Yeah, that's right. It's kind of a give and take, because, you know, there were a couple seasons there where I was kind of thinking, you know, Danny's just spinning her wheels. And I know she's supposed to be an A character, but I'm kind of bored with all of the stuff in Marine, right?
Right.
So now we have the, like, A character and A, you know, A1 character and AB character in the same room together. And Danny is really interesting to me right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so you gave me that, and that's thrilling, but you took away a fair amount of, you know, other things that made me like Game of Thrones. I don't know. I mean, I think that there's something that's, okay, this is how a lot of superhero movies are. It's like the third act is always the problem.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You feel like, well, we got to give the fans a spectacle. And I kind of feel like season 7 and 8 for Game of Thrones is the third act. And
okay.
So the question is, are you going to, you know, do this slow knife approach, or are you going to do the spectacle approach?
No, and that's fair. And that's one of my pet peeves, right? Is like that's where I think Man of Steel was such a bummer. Man of Steel sets up, and it could be really playing with some of the things that I find the most interesting about Superman, and then it becomes a spectacle, and I'm like, this is the least anything I want. So there is that potential, but there also is, you know, if the third act, in many cases, if the first two acts are done well, the third act is almost bound to disappoint because it's moving towards conclusion.
Unless you're going into it thinking that that's what I want. I mean, you go to these Fast and Furious movies thinking, I want to see some kick-ass car chase or whatever. Or you go into like a John Wick movie thinking, I'm going to see nonstop third act from beginning to end, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you know that that's what you want to see going in, that's fine. But if I go in thinking, okay, this is House of Cards set in the medieval period.
Sure.
With some magic peppered in. And then at the end, you're giving me like Iron Man 2.
Sure.
Then I'm not going to be super excited about how it ends.
No, and that makes sense. I mean, like, and that is, but I just feel like it's such a, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
If you make it long and drawn out and it just sort of ends with the slow knife, like you say, you're going to have people like, well, that's what, I mean, I've been doing that all along.
Well, and I will say this, talk about slow knife. When Littlefinger talks to Sansa and says, here's the secret.
Everyone is your enemy. Everyone is your friend. Every possible series of events is happening all at once. Live that way and nothing will surprise you. Everything that happens will be something that you've seen before.
I kind of felt like, that's a great Game of Thrones line.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the guy that plays the long game. This is the guy with the slow knife. And he's giving his best advice to the person who I want to have that advice.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a wonderful Game of Thrones moment in a pretty decent episode, right?
Yeah.
And so then the question is, am I going to quibble over pacing issues, or am I just going to enjoy those moments? And I think that in general, these last couple of seasons, you kind of have to do that. You kind of have to say, I'm just going to focus on that one really cool Game of Thrones moment, because that's going to bring me enjoyment. And I'm going to have to overlook these pacing issues and, you know, some other stuff that, in other words, I think these episodes can be enjoyable. And I think that a lot of times fans who are really invested will simply choose to focus on the parts that don't work.
Right.
Because the bar is just so high. I'll tell you what, Steve, if I needed anyone to help me construct an IKEA piece of furniture, Sam would be my guy. He looked in the book. He followed the instructions.
How did you do this? I read the instructions. But here's the funny thing, man.
He's like the IT guy. It's like, how on earth did you fix this thing? I went on YouTube and I watched the video.
Well, that's exactly it, right? Like, I don't know how many times we'll go someplace and like we'll bring a dessert or we'll bring some sort of a dish. Yeah. Oh my God, this is fantastic. I just follow the recipe.
Some people got it and some people just don't
like,
got
like
it.
Like cocktails. Like, how did you come up with this? Well, I looked up and like, it would be a good cocktail. And this is one that came up and then I made it and they were right.
I just measured it out, I guess.
Yeah, and that's the other part is that I know a lot of people when it comes to cooking or cocktails, they don't do the measure out. They kind of eyeball. I have a lot of times they're like, oh yeah, I just sort of see, you know, I just throw in the booze. And I'm like, yeah, well, that's the like cocktails that people will be like, man, those are delicious. But when I go home and make it, I just can't ever seem to recreate it. It's like, yeah, because you want more booze in it. And I get it. Uh-huh. You can afford to do that because you go to a bar and they're like, hey, you're only giving me 1.5 ounces. I want 2, 2.5, 3. It's like, okay, then the recipe changes. You're not going to have, like, this is really different. Like, yeah, because it's more alcohol. They know how much alcohol they're going to give you, so they do the rest of the stuff to balance that. You can modify your recipe if you want to add more booze, but I don't know. Sam.
So Sam could make a mean IKEA advisor, but he also would make a great bartender.
Mm-hmm.
I think actually that may be his calling. I think that because if you go up to the bar. I mean, he's well-read. He's a great conversationalist. He's always going to be, you know.
He's going to lend you an ear.
He's gonna be polite. He's going to be kind. And he's going to make you a kick-ass drink.
Yeah.
If John is king, I want there to be a master of cocktails. And I want it to be Sam.
A Cheers reboot where Sam has a little pub. I mean, he's already got the name.
God. Taking a break from all your worries sure would help a lot. Wouldn't you like to get away? Sometimes you want to go where everybody knows your name, and they're always glad you came. You want to be where you can see our troubles are. Everybody knows your name.
It's a fitting compliment, perhaps, to Game of Thrones because it is as hopefully as funny as Game of Thrones is serious and creepy.
Sure, sure.
It's set in Los Angeles rather than Westeros, although sure. LA has its magical side. But I share with Martin, as different as our books are, I share with Martin his interest in kid protagonists.
Yeah,
because the protagonist of Pretend Plumber is kind of a Game of Thrones age. She's 13, almost 14.
Right.
And that's an age that's particularly interesting to me in terms of how that such a person sees the world.
So tell me about your main character. Just name and what is she worried about? I'm curious about those two things.
She's worried about a lot, actually. Her name is Saracene Anfang, Anfang is German for beginning, so it's a great it's a great last name. Good. She's a precocious, queer, curious Los Angeles teenager who is also Jewish, and she is really fed up with her wealthy but kind of incompetent white-collar family. She has very serious plumbing problems in her house in Los Angeles, this fancy house. The plumbing isn't working. Everything is backing up. No one knows how to fix it. No one knows what to do. No one knows who to call. And she decides at that point, where as all the sludge is backing up, that she's going to run away and become a plumber.
Oh, interesting. Oh, so she's not going to fix the problem in her own house.
She's going to learn how to become a plumber. She's had it with the whole family.
Uh-huh.
So she runs away and this is, you know, in quotations, to her grandfather's condo on Wilshire. So she has to get on the bus and go to his place. That's her plan. Uh-huh. What she doesn't know is that her Godiva chocolate eating, practical Kabbalah practicing grandmother has other plans for her.
Is that okay?
So there is magic in the novel, and there are some famous spirits from the Jewish past that appear.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so it sounds like family members and spirits and pipes are conspiring to create problems for our heroine.
For Sarah-cine,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, very good. So she has a lot to worry about.
She has a lot to worry about, but she is not the smartest person, but she has a lot of empathy, as her therapist has told her. So she feels confident that she can figure things out.
Okay. I can't wait. I absolutely can't wait. This is fantastic. All right. Now, how do people get their hands on this? I'm assuming that we'll put this out, you know, either close to when people can purchase it or shortly, you know, either shortly before or shortly after. So maybe
it should be available. It'll be available in April.
Okay,
or certainly sometime after that. And you can order it from your favorite bookstore.
Wonderful. Fantastic. And people can search Stephanie Barbie Hammer.
Correct.
And they might find your website, which is a website devoted to magical realism. Do I have that right?
It's called Writing Unreal.
Okay, Writing Unreal. And then the publisher's name is what?
It's Inlandia Books.
Oh, Inlandia Books. Inlandia. I'm writing this down. Inlandia Books. And
you can also find my author page on Facebook.
Uh-huh.
And you can also find my books on Amazon.
Well, I'm sure that many of our readers will want to do that, because you've been such a lovely and frequent guest that I'm sure that many, many of our readers have fallen in love with your voice and might want to see it on the page as well.
Oh, shucks. Well, I appreciate that. Well, Sarah-cine is an amazing character. She's my favorite character that I've ever created, and she has an amazing voice. And I hope readers will check her out, because it's an adventure that does not disappoint.
Absolutely. Thank you, Stephanie.
You bet. Thank you so much, Anthony. I really appreciate you.